You are tuned in to the NTD Broadcast Network presentation of Off Camera with Sam Jones. The best conversations happen off camera.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Off Camera. I'm your host, Sam Jones, and today I sit down with Ed Helms, editor, musician, actor, comedian. Ed Helms makes it all look easy. And for him, it kind of is. The secret? A supportive, if showbiz ignorant family helps, as does a seemingly bottomless supply of self-confidence. Helms left a happy, successful career as a commercial editor to take his chances in comedy, with none of the attendant anxiety you'd expect with such a move. Why? He was just pretty sure he could do it. And he was right, landing at The Daily Show as one of its best and most beloved correspondents. As far as Helms was concerned, he was pretty much in his dream job when he was offered a role on The Office, but with no guarantees Andy Bernard would live beyond a couple of episodes. Risk an established career for what could easily be a rapid sitcom death? He figured he could do that too. And we all know how that worked out. Helms talks to Off Camera about the arc of his career, his band, Andy Bernard's mad banjo skills are real, kids, how The Hangover impacted his life, and his rampant curiosity about, well, almost everything. Don't mistake Ed's confidence for arrogance. Chalk it up to his hard work and equal parts respect and disregard for fear. But mostly, this most happy fella simply loves every moment of what he does, whatever that happens to be in the moment, which is probably why we do too. So pull up a chair and listen in. So,
Ed?
Hey.
We're on.
Sorry. Just give me a second. I'm working this out.
You got it. No problem.
Cool.
You ready?
No. Hang on.
Okay. All right.
This is a beautiful guitar, Sam.
Well, that's a parting gift. All our guests get a guitar.
All right. So I'm going to hold on to that. Thank you very much.
That's where we throw in the crashing sound effect right there. Ed Helms.
Samuel.
Thank you.
L. Jones. It is my pleasure.
Well, speaking of the guitar, the first time I met you, you were noodling around on the guitar, and I remember thinking, God, he's a really good guitar player. And I never asked you how you got started playing instruments.
I got my first guitar, which I still have and play all the time, when I was 13. I got it for Christmas. And it was because I begged my parents for a guitar. Why was I so excited about a guitar at that time? I don't really remember. I've always loved playing instruments. I didn't practice what I was told to practice. I just liked to play my own stuff and mess around. And then I got very into acoustic music for some reason. I was listening to a lot of like blues and bluegrass, like old stuff at a young age, and made me really want a guitar.
How did you find that music at a young age?
I went to summer camp in the mountains in North Carolina for a bunch of years. I started going when I was 6 years old. I went to sleepaway camp.
No kidding.
Yeah. My mom still apologizes for that.
That's really...
But I went to sleepaway camp for 3 weeks when I was 6 years old. And my mom worked at the camp across the street. So that's how she sort of justified it. She's like, oh, he's right across the street. But to me, she could have been in like Turkmenistan.
Right.
I was a lonely child for 3 weeks. But I was just in the Smoky Mountains in North Carolina every summer for 7-8 years and formative years. And this was the 80s. It's not like bluegrass was a hot thing,
right?
Hot new thing but I feel like we would just stop at a truck stop here or there and pick up, they would sell cassette tapes.
Yeah.
Just at the register, and there'd be like, Smoky Mountain String Band Hits or something, and we'd just get it and pop it in the cassette in the car and listen to it. And that's Those are some of my first memories of hearing that music, of hearing like bluegrass and mountain music. Then in school, I was a little bit of a loner, I guess, and I kind of, you know, was very into the whole Catcher in the Rye, Dead Poets Society thing of like authenticity and being like a real person and searching for truth, and of course being envious slash judgmental towards the popular kids and always feeling kind of on the fringe of popularity. So that drove me to seek out things that are authentic, whatever that means. And to me, like old Delta blues and old mountain music, that was all authentic.
I look at that and I go, well, here's a guy who took a different path on purpose. I think that takes confidence as a kid.
Yeah, I have no shortage of insecurities and self-doubt and fears and anxieties, and I always have. But I do think that I don't know why, but for some reason, I think it was partly that kind of Dead Poets Society, like, do the thing you're called to do, like, you know, a little bit of that romantic right. passion for your calling or just kind of finding that thing. And at a young age, I did really feel like I could do whatever I wanted to do. And I hope to God I can instill that in children that I hope to have at some point.
Did your parents push that in you? I mean, were they a part of that? Or is that something you found out on your own out, you know, in the world through books and movies?
My parents were never, they weren't like artsy fartsy, you know, you can be anything. My dad wanted me to be a lawyer, and he was, he definitely was kind of like straight and narrow. As a matter of fact, when we saw Dead Poets Society as a family, and he was like, I don't understand why the dad was such a villain. He was, you know, the dad that, yeah. that makes
yeah.
Ethan Hawke or the other guy commit Who? Suicide.
Right. And your dad was like, hey, he's being a pretty good dad.
Yeah, he's like, it's like, it's what dads do. Like, tell kids what to do. I mean, kid was out of line. Wanted to be in a play. He got to study. I don't know. But, so yeah, that's all that's to say, it's the only reason I got as far as I have in comedy, too, is because I just believed I could do it. I just, like, I knew if I worked hard, I could do something. And I'd be psyched about it.
I find that interesting because a lot of actors you talk to and their story is pretty much, God, you know, if acting didn't work out, I didn't know what I was going to do because, you know, I was going to have to be a bartender or something because this is all I knew how to do and I dropped out of high school and everything. But you strike me as someone who kind of had a lot of options. And I took that away from your speech. You recently gave the commencement speech at Knox University this last summer, and you...
Knox College.
Knox College.
I also received an honorary doctorate.
I saw that.
Thank you very much, nice moment. Dr. Helms.
Dr. Helms. Is it okay if I address you just as Ed, or should I say doctor throughout the...
Dr. Ed.
Dr. Ed. So what I took from that speech was that you had a lot of options, and you had... moved to New York and you were working as a post-production, you were an editor at a post-production
house. I was an assistant editor, yeah.
What I took from the speech was that something inside you wasn't going to let you settle for that, but that you had a lot of other options, like you probably could have been a successful editor or a successful post-production company owner or many other things. And what it made me wonder is do you think if you have a lot of options, maybe sometimes it's harder to pick one and really focus on it?
I don't think I had necessarily more options than a lot of people, but I had a lot of curiosity and a lot of interests. And again, like I did have this this bug in me that felt like if I just work my ass off, I know I'll make it work. I know I can be either a comedian or an editor or... The one thing I didn't think I could do was be a musician.
Really?
Yeah. I didn't... I never have had the confidence in my music. And it's, in my adult life, it's inverted. I have become much more confident as a musician and way more full of questions about, like, my chosen career of comedy and all that. Like, there's...
No kidding.
More, yeah, it's like, it's been this weird roller coaster. But yeah, when I was in my 20s, I was just fearless. And I would go up on stage and do stand-up just bomb. And I loved it. It was like, I was earning stripes, you know, and the other comedians, we'd all high-five each other after horrible sets, and like, if we got heckled really badly, it's like, it was a badge of honor.
Really?
You know? Yeah.
So, okay, so when you, take me through that. Like, take me through a 24-year-old Ed living in New York. Are you working as an editor in the daytime and then doing clubs at night? Like, paint that picture for me.
Okay, so I moved to New York when I was 22, and I immediately started working. I wanted to be either a filmmaker or a comedian. Music was not a thing. It was a hobby. And so I thought, I was scared of comedy. I wanted to do it, but I was still scared of it. So I started taking some improv classes and stuff. But I also, for some reason, I felt like being a filmmaker was the easier path of less resistance, let's say. And so that's how I got into post-production, and I wanted to be an editor. I wanted to learn how to cut films together. And I became an assistant editor at this really cool post-production company called Crew Cuts, which was cutting really high-end Super Bowl commercials and music videos. They cut the opening credits to Saturday Night Live and all this cool stuff. And so I felt kind of in the thick of it, and I was learning a lot. But that's an insane job. I mean, I was working 14 hours a day, and I was up at 6 to get in early to prep the room for my editor and clients and whatever. And I was taking some improv classes and in a sketch group, and I just squeezed it in. But comedy wasn't a big thing those first few years. It was just kind of this thing that I was churning and dancing around and experimenting with a little bit. At a certain point, my editor, my boss, said, you know, maybe we should start our own company. And like, I promote you to editor and all this. And I was like, that's the best possible outcome of this job that I have.
Right, to have your own company.
Yeah, for him to invite me to do that, it's like, that's a clear path towards, and at the time, you know, advertising was booming, huge budget commercials. You don't see that anymore, but, you know, the Joe Pitkas and the Chris Cunninghams and these guys were just blowing out these massive, gorgeous Nike commercials, and we were doing that. We were editing that stuff. And that was sort of the turning point, and I had to say to him, like, I can't do that, honestly. If I do that, if I happen to get a part in a movie or something, which was crazy, but I thought, if I do get a comedy opportunity or something, I'm going to take it. So I can't honestly, like, go and start this thing, like, jump in the trenches with you and do this. I just wanted to do the comedy more than the filmmaking at that point. I wanted to take the comedy plunge. And so I quit my job.
Was there the practical thing that kicked in and said, I should do this? Or were you pretty clear that you had to leave?
100% both. Like, I was tortured. I was just wringing my heart and like, what do I do? I love my boss. I love what we do. It's really creatively gratifying and exciting. And yet, like, if I just kind of peeled away everything, it was so clear. I had to just, of course, I have to do stand-up now. I'm 25, 26. Like, if I don't start now, I just won't know.
What made you want to do stand-up?
I wanted to be Eddie Murphy, Mike Myers, Chris Farley, David Spade, Adam Sandler. You may have picked up a common thread here. They're all Saturday Night Live. And that was my obsession. Like a lot of comedians, a lot of comedy actors, like I loved Saturday Night Live. And there was something, Eddie Murphy is my all-time favorite. He is the king. And when I saw him on Saturday Night Live, I was right at the age, I think he was on around 82 or 3 in those years.
Yep.
And so I was like just under 10 years old, and I didn't get the jokes. I didn't know what was going on. All I knew is that this guy was bursting with energy and confidence, and people were laughing, and it just seemed like the most fun thing to be a part of.
Did you have a whole plan in mind, or was it get on Saturday Night Live?
I saw Saturday Night Live as a life horizon. That was it. Like, if I could get there, I'm done. And everything else falls into place. That's the illusion of a job, of that's the fantasy of a young person. Like, you just don't quite get it. But it was enough for me. Like, so the whole intent was to do stand-up, work on my characters, get my kind of Saturday Night Live audition hashed out. And after I'd been doing stand-up a few years, the Upright Citizens Brigade started in New York, and kind of that became a real thing. And I was like, I want to be a part of that. Got involved in that scene, and that gave me a lot of confidence in sort of character work. And my stand-up at the time was a lot of kind of weird characters and mixed with storytelling. And it was all that was the goal.
Saturday Night Live.
Yeah. And so right about the time, I started to get to this point where I was playing a number of clubs with some regularity, and I was just sort of on the radar. Like, I was in the scene, and I remember thinking, like, this is gonna happen. Like, I'm gonna get an audition at some point. I better be ready.
Thinking about that speech you gave, Dr. Helms, you said that you would tape your performances and you go back and listen to them, and you would say that bombing was more valuable to you than succeeding because you got so much more data out of sucking than out of killing.
Right.
And it made me think, like, okay, so for, you know, when you go up there and you really tank, I wonder what, you know, what makes you go back and do it again? If it's, you know, you gotta have a lot of belief in yourself to go up there and be told that you're not good at this in real time in front of live people, right?
Yeah, but you don't look at it, I mean, you can't look at one spot as a referendum on your talent or on your ability to do this. You just have to look at it as, I mean, there's a million variables every show, from who's in the audience to how many people are in the audience to what the location, where you are geographically, either in the city or in the country. There's so many factors that influence how well or how terribly a stand-up set goes. And if you can just kind of like remember that, you're going to be less hard on yourself about the caliber of a given set. And you can walk away from a bad set and be like, okay, that sucked. What did I learn? And I recorded everything.
What would you listen for?
I mostly listened to myself. I wasn't listening to the audience as much. You could tell when obviously you're hearing laughter, you can tell when something's doing well. But I had a very strong opinion about what was funny and why, and I would miss the mark a lot. Like, I would even, because the way that I've read about a lot of different comedians and their different processes in creating stand-up material, and some people sit down and they write, and they just write material. I heard Eddie Izzard interviewed, and it's it popped to me because he described a process that I use also, which is that you write down ideas that you think are funny and you kind of hash them out a little bit in your mind, but you're not writing anything. Then you get on stage with that. And you do some material that you feel confident about, and you start to mix in a couple of those ideas that are new. And what I found is that the pressure of being on stage in front of people clicked some gears in my brain that generated things that I liked and that I was psyched about and that I would hold on to. So I would record the sets, and then I would transcribe things that I liked. I would transcribe jokes that came out pretty spontaneously, kind of in an improvisational way. And if I was psyched about an idea, like if I thought something was funny, I'll give you an example. I got off an elevator one time and I turned around and I thanked the person, another passenger in the elevator, for the ride.
Right.
You know, because like I was in, and I got off the elevator and I thanked this person, the door closed, and I was like, that was hilarious. Like, why did I just thank this person? What was going on in my brain? And so I just decided I'm going to talk about that on stage tonight. And I get up and I talk about it, and maybe it tanks. And I didn't think about it right. So I think about it more. I get in front of the mirror and start telling jokes to myself and like talking out loud and get a couple of things that sound right or sound pretty funny. And do it again. Let's tape it, listen to it. It just gets better and better, and hopefully it gets better and better.
Right. But, or you find out it doesn't go anywhere and you put it away, but...
Right.
You know, you're saying this, and I'm reminded of something I read about the way Bob Dylan would work a lot, where he would...
Please, compare me to Bob Dylan.
No. He would ride an elevator. No, he would go in the studio, and he wouldn't have a song idea in mind, necessarily, but... start playing something and then just start singing the first thing that came off the top of his head, and then he'd run back and listen to what he said, and if anything sounded rhythmic or interesting, he would try to take that and actually get an idea from that phrase.
Totally.
The way you describe a stand-up routine, it's identical, and the added pressure of having the audience there, so you can't cheat, right? You have to finish your thought.
I never was good at homework. I never did a lot. I got terrible grades because I almost never did homework. I'm confident in my kind of ability to wing it.
Right.
And so that's my process as a comedian, emphasized that. And I put a lot of trust and faith in my being able to like push my personality a little bit to fit a performance. Whereas a lot of guys, Steve Martin, one of my great heroes as a comedian and a musician, is a studious writer. You know, if you read his autobiography,
sure.
It's like he does the homework, and it's a different mindset. And he comes to stage like prepared with things that jokes that are planned and sharp and he knows are good. I am a little messier in my approach. And I guess it's what's worked for me.
I kind of notice a theme here, because you mentioned authenticity earlier, and it's like trying to get to that gut feeling or that core of who you are. You know, sometimes just having to, like you say, wing it, maybe something more truthful comes out because there's not as many filters.
I think there is still a little bit of that angsty teenager in me that resents artifice and I try to be a genuine person in my life and on stage. I try to present a pretty close approximation of who I am, but at the same time, it's heightened because I want it to be entertaining. And if I can be close to who I am, then it comes naturally, it comes easier. But it's hard to be who we are sometimes.
Yeah. So did all this lead to a Saturday Night Live audition?
Well, so, you know, it's all I wanted was the right. Saturday Night Live audition. And it started to feel like it could happen in the next year or two. And right at that same time, I was on Comedy Central's radar. And I had kind of decided at that point that this other show that I was obsessed with would be okay also. And that was The Daily Show. So it was like, I loved, it had been this singular one-track pursuit of Saturday Night Live. And somewhere in my mid-20s, it became, all right, Saturday Night Live or The Daily Show. I love both these shows. And I feel like I could do a good job on The Daily Show because I felt like I got it or something. And I got that audition.
So take me through that. How is it, do you come in and get to perform whatever material you want, or do they have something written for you?
Well, this is where I sat down in that waiting room and I looked around and I was like, I have an edge on everyone in this room because I am a devout fan of this show. I watch it every single night. I just got my sides for the audition. It's a segment that Stephen Colbert did last Tuesday. I know exactly how he did it. That was the audition. It was a segment they had just done on the show. And I saw a lot of people like around the room kind of trying to figure it out and crack it and like be newsy or whatever. And I was like, I got this. I know how this is going to work. And so I got in there and I just did it. You know, I kind of did my best Stephen Colbert impression. And that got me a callback.
So what was the callback, another sketch from the show, or was the callback different?
Callback was another sketch from the show that had been on. It was, but it was in the studio this time with John.
Okay.
So we actually like did a chat banter thing with John.
How was that?
It was terrifying and exhilarating and went well enough that I got a trial segment.
Like a remote?
Yeah. Or, yeah. Like a field piece.
Okay.
It was sort of like, you're not hired. Why don't you go do this field piece? We'll see how it goes. I was like, all right, let's do this.
So in my experience, because that's how my career started too, was, well, we'll give you a shot. And, you know, so was that field piece, that first one, did you just kill yourself on it to make it great?
I don't know how or why, Sam, but I was really confident. And I just felt like I'm in the right spot. This is where I've worked to get. I know how I'm gonna do this. I know my voice. I was so ahead of myself. I was so arrogant, but at the same time, like, I'm grateful that I had that because it kind of powered me through. And it wasn't until like a year later on the show where I really was like, God damn, am I doing this right? Like, this is going well. And I really started to question everything. And then what I've learned since then is that it's all a cycle. Like, life is just, sometimes you feel great about what you're doing. Sometimes you feel horrible about what you're doing. Sometimes you're excited about kind of where you stand in the bigger picture. Sometimes you're terrified about where you stand. And if you ever have any more good work left in you or whatever, and these things come and go. And if you happen to be cresting in confidence at the same time that a wonderful opportunity presents itself, then that is a wonderful and blessed thing. And it doesn't always happen. I've been confronted with opportunities where I was at a nadir of confidence and I fucked them up, or I did a bad job, or I made a bad choice. I made a bad career decision or something that I wasn't happy with because I wasn't feeling good. I wasn't feeling kind of on top of my game and in control. I will say at that time, and I got a little lecture from my field producer, this Jo Honig. She was so cool. I got to work and I was like, all right, let's do this. Let's get going on this field piece. I got all these ideas. And she was like, you need to cool it. You just need to calm down. The one thing that doesn't work here at The Daily Show is people who are too eager and love this job too much. And I was like, got it. Cool. cucumber.
Really?
I'm cool. Let's do this. And I kind of clicked into like cool mode. Of course, inside I was like, yeah, you know, like super happy. It was, yeah, just a really, that was a fun, crazy time.
And at that point, did your Saturday Night Live thing, it went away? You're like, I'm on my way. I'm here.
Yeah, I knew that once I was on the, once I had been on The Daily Show for a little while and had become a regular, that Saturday Night Live was no longer a possibility. Because part of that casting process is pulling from obscurity.
Sure.
It happens, but it's very rare that they pull known actors.
Sure.
And so, especially from a competing late night comedy show, like in New York City, that would just be unheard of. So, I was totally at peace with that.
Yeah. Who did you learn the most from The Daily Show?
I think Stephen Colbert was a model in so many ways. As a person who just moves through the world with integrity and with just solid values, and as a comedian who works hard, trusts his instincts, has great instincts, and is at peace with his own questions and doubts. He said to me when I was such a giddy fan that for those first few weeks or months.
Right.
And I loved him, and Carell was there at the time, and I loved Carell, and I thought they were so, so good. And I was going out on my first field piece. I'd been in the office a few days having meetings and writing sessions and stuff. And I was just about to go off and shoot it, and Colbert walks by, and I was like, hey, Stephen, any advice for my first field piece? And he goes, yeah, hang your soul up in the closet. You can come back for it later. And he was basically saying, like, you really have to kind of be a manipulative weirdo on these field segments. And Carell and I talked a lot about this over the years on The Office, just that is tough. It's hard on your constitution to be... The extreme version is like all the Sacha Cohen characters.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Just like taking honest people who are engaging with you honestly and kind of playing a game with them.
Right.
And that, no matter how hypocritical they might be or how insane their point of view might be, like, you're still kind of being disingenuous. And that was tough. That was a tough thing.
Right. Well, I remember a piece in particular about the Texas town that renamed itself Dish. And I wonder how much is, you know, when you're speaking to the mayor or whoever it is in town, how much is unbeknownst to them versus how much they're acting? Like, was it always different? Was it always different levels of coercion? Like, sometimes it was, they were completely playing along, and other times?
Yes.
How did it work?
Well, people rarely played along. If people played along, then it was pretty useless.
Right.
Because they were trying to be funny or something, and we'd just move on. But I was always shocked at the people that agreed to talk to us, but especially if they knew the show. But what I realized is that people who thought they knew the show well had the most arrogance going into an interview, because they were like, I know what you're going to try to do, and I'm going to beat you. But what they don't realize is that we do this all day, and right, we're good at it. And we also take the footage back with us, and we sit with it for 2 weeks, and we take the pieces we like. You have no control over that. And so the arrogant people who were like, yeah, give me your worst, like, they were the easiest targets, because they were ready to engage and they thought they had the upper hand and they were talkative. The people that, I remember this one guy, because even as someone sitting there trying to get comedy out of an interview, I would ask myself, like, how would I handle this interview if I was this guy?
Right.
You know, like, what's the best tactic against a Daily Show interview? And the one guy who really genuinely thwarted me, and we used some of him anyway because it was funny how good he was, but it was a piece about the Arizona gun laws. There was a guy fighting a law that made guns illegal in bars. It's illegal to bring guns into bars. There was a Arizona lawmaker saying, that law is unreasonable. People should be allowed to bring guns into bars. So, of course, we took the position, this guy is absolutely right. This is a perfectly sound point of view. And I went and interviewed his opposition, another state legislator, who was like, guns and bars don't mix.
Right.
Should not bring alcohol, guns, not a good combination. And we need, as a state, we need to have this law to keep people safe. And I'd say, well, like, what if a bear comes into a bar? What do you do if a bear comes into a bar?
Right.
And he would look right in my eye and say, guns and bars don't mix. And I realized after about 5 minutes, 10 minutes of this, I realized, like, I'm not going to get very far with this guy.
Yeah.
Because he never actually took the bait.
Right.
You know?
I mean, when you think of all the skills that it takes to be in that situation, like debate team skills and improv skills, and do you think that one of the things that the show recognized about you was that kind of high wire sort of thing in your act?
I would say the most important attribute to have as a correspondent on that show is a writing instinct, because during interviews, you're seizing on opportunities and moments and looking for irony. You're looking for something that you can turn and flip and have fun with, or a road you can go down, or a left turn. And the interviews, when you get what you went for, are generally pretty boring.
Right.
But when you get something that starts to light up and you can feel, you get somebody gets agitated or really unreasonable or really, you know, hypocritical or whatever that nugget is, you kind of have to have the instinct to follow those things.
Now, was your relationship with Steve Carell on the show, did that ultimately lead to your original stint in The Office?
That is a reasonable assumption, but it's not accurate. I really didn't know Steve Carell very well. Huh. We'd only met a few times at The Daily Show. When I started, he was already spending a lot of time on the West Coast and was auditioning for sitcoms and things. But we did some photo shoots together, and we were in the office at the same time a few times. And I think there's one round of cast photos on The Daily Show in which we're both cast members at the same time. But it was really only a few months of overlap. So I didn't know him very well.
Right.
The Office came about because I did a pilot at NBC about 3 or 4 years into my time at The Daily Show. Mm-hmm. I did a pilot on NBC that didn't get picked up, but they liked me and had me meet a bunch of showrunners. And that's when I met Greg Daniels. And I think he had seen a short that I did called Zombie American, which was way before the zombie craze.
You were first with the zombies.
Well, I was early, I should say. But let's be honest, the zombie craze is like 50 years old.
Yes.
But I made a little short with my friend Nick Poppy. It was his idea, actually, to be a zombie who just couldn't catch a break, having a rough time, rough go of it, going on blind dates, you know, having pieces of his body fall off, and just like,
just sucks.
Just trying to make his way. Like, he lived in an apartment in Brooklyn and just was having a rough time. So we did this little 10-minute short, and Greg saw that, and I've never asked him. I should ask him. But I think that it was very office-y in tone.
Okay.
It was very deadpan, and it was very, like, you know, it was mockumentary style, talking to camera, mixed with B-roll. And I think that Greg saw some sort of office potential in that.
So Greg Daniels really maybe picked up on your office-like tone in your own filmmaking, because I always had a question about that, which is how involved each character is in that show, and you specifically, in the creation of the character and the writing of the material.
There was some amount of architecture already there in terms of archetypes for the characters and whatnot. Andy Bernard was a total new invention for the show. Had no analog on the British show.
How involved were you in creating Andy Bernard?
Well, when my very first meeting with Greg Daniels, I sat down with him and Paul Lieberstein, and they are kind of odd, distracted guys, and they'll tell you that themselves. Like I'm not saying anything that they wouldn't say.
Right.
And I sat in that interview, and they said, we have this idea for this character who might be sort of a yacht club kid, or, like, you know, and he's kind of obnoxious. Do you have any thoughts? And I was like, well, I don't know. Yeah, like, he's this or that, and threw some things out, and it was very nebulous. And I didn't know, even after that meeting, that if it would ever come to be. Sometime later, I got the call to start the character, to do this 8-episode arc. And we got into production. And what I learned very quickly, and I was very excited about, is that the writing staff is paying very close attention to everything that's going on. And anything that you improvise or endow your character with, be it a speech pattern or a little nugget of personal history or some physicality, the writers are picking up on that and either amplifying it or kind of using more of it in some way. And it became this really cool symbiotic feedback loop of character development. And I felt very much a part of it, even though I wasn't in the room being like, hey, what if Andy, you know, had a,
right,
one ear was lower than the other or whatever. I did feel a part of it because I felt listened to. I felt like my contributions were being kind of taken in and considered. And that was really, really exciting because I was improvising a lot too, and certainly those first couple of seasons I was on, that was a big part of how I saw my role on the show was to improvise a lot.
Was there any of that, you know, kind of calculating of, I can turn this into a larger arc than 8 episodes? Like, how much did you have a part in that decision?
Zero.
Zero.
Yeah, around 5-6 episodes in, the conversation started. Maybe there's a place for Andy in Scranton, but I really wasn't a part of it. And the only part of it was, would you do it if we offered it? And I was like, yeah, I would do that.
Now, was that a tough thing for you? Like, was that
super tough?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, now in these decisions, is there someone that, like, people rarely make decisions totally alone. Is there someone you kind of talk that out with, like someone in your family or a friend?
I talked it out with a lot of people. You know, my family, who I love, I have such a great family. They're completely useless when it comes to show business, and God bless them for it. I wouldn't have it any other way. But I definitely talked to a lot of comedy friends, but what I found is, and this is so corny and hacky to say, but, like, if you just strip it all away, like, you know the answer. You always know the answer. And then you just have to decide, like, am I going to go with that or not?
Okay, so you're facing this thing. I'm on The Daily Show. It was one of my life goals. And here's 8 episodes of a television show.
Yeah.
And then I will be unemployed.
Right. I'll tell you the calculus behind the decision. It was ultimately a gut choice. But the sort of thought that went into it was, I've been on The Daily Show 4.5 years. I've done everything that The Daily Show has to offer. There's nothing I can do on The Daily Show at this point that will change the perception of what Ed Helms is capable of doing as a comedian or an actor. And I can stay on the show longer, and which I loved the show, but I was also getting weary because it was a phenomenal amount of travel. The correspondents at the time, there were only 4 of us, and they were just like pinging us all over the country for field segments. And that was really wearing me down. There was some energy there at times that I wasn't vibing with. And so I think that it really came down to, I just was feeling a really powerful need to stretch the perception of what I'm capable of. I knew I could act. I knew I could be a good character on a TV show or in a movie. And The Daily Show would never prove that. There would never afford me an opportunity to prove that. So that was really the math behind the decision.
That's stripping it away and knowing that.
Well, then you got to strip down the thing of like, can you handle this? Like, can you handle this life change and this risk? And what if it's only, honestly, they said it was going to be 8 episodes, but they wouldn't commit to more than 2.
Oh, really?
So the basically the office was saying, we have this crazy storyline where Jim goes off to Stamford, Connecticut. You work in that office. If the fans erupt in anger, we're probably going to nix that storyline. And I don't know if that was said, articulated to me, but it was very clear because they wouldn't give me more than 2 actual episodes, even though they said it's an 8-episode arc. So it was a huge risk. It was terrifying, but it was also like, I stripped it all away. It's like, of course I have to do this. And a couple of close friends I talked to were like, absolutely, go for it.
Okay, so getting back to being on the show, and you spoke of improvisation, how did that work in practice? Was it that the writers encouraged change and just would play out a scene several different ways? Or how did the improv actually take place on the set?
On The Office?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I didn't really ask. I just started to improvise. I just would try to improvise a lot. And what I found was early on, I think that there was just a lot of leeway because this Stamford branch was new. We were all new characters. There was definitely a kind of like play around and find stuff energy.
That line between improvisation and writing, like, did you ever, were you ever a credited writer on the show or no? So, but over time, it's like, we're getting the show done. We're making the best show we can. So everyone's
sure.
Kind of.
I always felt like the correspondents and the field producers on The Daily Show should have been given more writing credit than they ever got.
Right.
I think now they do. Most of the correspondents are staff writers now. But at the time, when I was there, only Colbert was a staff writer. And but we were all writing so much of our segments, and we were out in the field like improvising moments and working on sitting in the editing room like writing the voiceover for our segments and slaving over this stuff. On The Office, I don't think of improvisation as writing.
You don't.
I know people do. A lot of people do. Maybe that's controversial, but I think that it's a little silly to say I improvise these lines. I need a writing credit.
Sure.
Because why are you even saying the lines in the first place? Because a writer created the script and the scene and the moment and everything else around it and the whole universe that you're sitting in.
But it's interesting when you say, you know, like Greg hires writer actors, hires people that are quick and with things like that. And you know, I've spoken at length with Judd Apatow about this too, is that you'd rather have somebody that likes that challenge in front of your camera than not. Because
sure.
I always feel like the best idea in the room should win, no matter whose idea it is. And that goes for if you're directing a commercial or a music video or doing a photo shoot or writing a film or whatever it is. And you know, I think that in a way it's kind of, it's a way to give yourself a little career insurance too, because I'm sure now you probably one of the things that you get hired for is also that ability. I would think that like, oh, we'll bring Ed on, he'll make it funnier. And that, they don't know how he's going to make it funnier, but you know, is that a valid point?
I hope so. I still think that the I still think that I mean, you brought up Mindy and BJ as writer actors on The Office. Well, yeah, they're on set and maybe they're improvising some great lines here and there, but they're also in the writer's room 10 hours a day.
Right.
They're writing. Like, they're actually in there. They're pitching stories. They're sitting there writing dialogue. That's writing. That's what a writer does. An actor can be a great improviser and a great comedian or a great contributor to the movie, but to me that sort of falls under the umbrella of like
performance.
Yeah, what a good actor should do. You know, you should bring a lot to the table and you should do your homework and be prepared. And
because I think every actor approaches how they prepare differently. And I read somewhere your interpretation originally of Andy Bernard was, okay, he's this East Coast upper crust douchebaggish guy, but he also has his insecurities, so I want to instill him with a heart. And I'm sure I'm paraphrasing the article, but it got me thinking about how you turn something like that on a page with very few clues into a full fleshed out person. Like, do you have a process that you've kind of worked out that works for you of creating a character and taking it into someone that's actually tactile and multidimensional?
Not really.
Really?
I mean, well, it goes back to when I was doing stand-up comedy and I was trying to kind of think in terms of like, well, what would Lorne Michaels like to see? Like, what should my SNL audition be? And so you come up with characters. And those characters are pretty one note. You know, they seem one note because they have like a joke.
Right.
To them, you know, like take Fred Armisen's Latin drummer guy.
Yes.
Sure. Dios mío. Like it looks like one joke, but that is insanely nuanced. His whole body inhabits that thing. All of his mannerisms, all of these things, they fall into place. And I'm sure Fred's not sitting there thinking like, well, how would he move his hand? Or how does he shake his hips? Like, he's not analyzing that. He's inhabiting it. And
well, maybe it's not that cerebral.
And
but so how do you...
That's all I'm saying, is that it isn't... For me, it's not this, like, complex analysis. I didn't go to acting school. I don't deconstruct too much. But I do try to kind of get some headlines in place and some physicality in place and maybe an outfit in place. Because these things all change how you feel and how you move, and those, that to me, like, if I feel like I have those things, then I can step onto a set confidently.
Right, because there is that thing when you do something new, you have to find whatever it is your little bag of things that make you confident, right?
You know, confidence is so important to good performance. Good anything, really. Good execution of a job is, confidence is such a huge part of it. And so, but confidence can also be very elusive. And it can depend on a lot of variables in your life that have nothing to do with your job or lots of things going on. And so you try to find tricks that make you feel in control, make you feel, you know, a solid baseline of confidence.
Right.
It doesn't always work.
Is there something that you go back to over and over again?
I don't know. There are certain people in my life whose affection is the most powerful life-affirming thing. The love of certain people in my life. And when I'm at my sort of most vulnerable or in places of the most despair, I can think about those people and be like, oh yeah.
That's so interesting.
They get me. They don't question me. Like they're not judging me for that, if I can, but sometimes even that's hard, you know, like I usually will try to tap into that.
You know, your life took such a massive turn around The Office and The Hangover. The creators of both those projects didn't go in with the idea of the success that they would end up being at all. You couldn't. Right? You couldn't write The Hangover and say, I'm going to write the largest grossing R-rated movie of all time. And you were involved in these two things that went on, you know, turned huge. And I wonder if it felt, first off, I wonder if it felt like success came quickly to you. Or if that's just an outside perception.
Yeah, Carell used to joke about that because people... when he did 40-Year-Old Virgin, everyone's like, overnight success. But he's like, I've been doing this for 20 years. So I don't feel like it came quickly. I feel like, you know, I was a hustling New York City stand-up for 5 years and then on a cable comedy show for another 5 years. And then The Office, like, the Andy's role grew over time, and
I wonder how life changed for you after that film, because it was such a massive, you know, it just got into everyone saw it.
Yeah, I mean, that's a whole can of worms. The kind of, if you want to get into that, just what happens when celebrity happens? It's just an incredibly complex force in your life, and it affects almost everything in a weird way.
It's a fascinating topic to me because it's one of those things where if you're not in it, you'll never fully understand it.
No,
that's
you can't.
My theory. And if you're in it, you probably can't fully explain it
or understand it either. You know, like, it's something that I don't think anyone really understands. It's a very psychologically complex experience. But I can tell you that it becoming famous changes your world experience so dramatically and so suddenly. That, I will say, was sudden. Like, it was like
you
hard
famous on The Daily Show. You
were
known.
Office. Exactly. And I had what Colbert used to call toy fame, which is like, you know, you could walk through an airport no problem, but the guy at the bagel shop might give you a free bagel, you know, because he's a fan of the show or whatever.
Right.
And even on The Office, like, I wasn't getting stopped regularly. It wasn't something. But the Hangover changed things. And it's a dramatic change in your reality is different. You can't, and is that change better or worse? maybe a bit of both, but change, just in and of itself, when it's that intense, is terrifying. It takes a lot of adjustment, and it takes a kind of process to accept, because a lot of things that you took for granted, a certain amount of anonymity, a certain way that you could deal with, have a business conversation or meet strangers and be in control of your perception to a stranger, as opposed to a stranger bringing to you a lot of perception already, or a lot of assumptions already about who you are and what you're about and all these things. I'm not an expert. I don't have it figured out. But it is a very interesting and, I think, at times scary, at times thrilling, at times fun, at times a burden. But you can't, it's funny how you described it. I don't think anyone can fully articulate fame or being famous and how it influences your life. And maybe that's why it's so compelling for so many people. It's such a, it's a mystery. I think Jimmy Stewart said, or somebody said, it makes the world a small town because people are happy to see you and happy to say hello. That's the nice part. And the not so nice part is just, especially in this modern era, just zero privacy.
Right.
Zero anonymity. You know, you can't be the weirdo. And if you're like, if you're going through some crisis in your life, like, you can't be the weirdo in the back of a coffee shop quietly weeping. That will be documented. That will be talked about. That will be written about or something. Whereas, you know, I can remember going through a breakup in my 20s and sitting in a coffee shop and being like really upset or doing something weird or I don't know, like, and
going to a bookshop for 3 hours.
Yeah.
Whatever. Yeah.
Like, just being left alone. And after a while, you realize that it's a little, you can kind of zen out about it. And it's taught me a lot about letting go and letting just sort of, letting go of things I can't control. And that's sort of carried over into other parts of my life where in relationships with friends or family or loved ones, all these things we try to control and like try to manage. When you're a celebrity, you can't manage how the people at a baggage claim at an airport are going to respond to you. You can't control that. You can't control how, you know, the waiter at some restaurant announces to the restaurant that you're there, or like, right. You know, these things.
Does that happen?
They're out of your, of course. Like, okay, I mean, I would say my life is generally feels pretty normal, punctuated by moments of just absurd surreality.
Right.
You know, I think that it's been nice. It's actually. So what if a waiter announces you're in a restaurant? Like, all right, big deal. It's not the end of the world. It's not, you know, I've learned to roll with things a lot more.
I could see how that would spill into the rest of your life, too, because you start probably just saying, okay, well, I'm going to have to accept myself because I am on public display.
So, yeah.
You know.
Yeah, you gotta roll with stuff that's unpleasant or awkward or you know, or just annoying. And you can either let it really burn you up and get bent out of shape about it, get frustrated, or you can realize like I can't really control this. unless I stay in my house all day long every day,
right?
Which some people do. Agoraphobia is a symptom of fame. It happens. But I don't want to do that. I'd rather just like try to face the world and move through it with some level of authenticity.
That's right. Well, I noticed, you know, in the relationships I have with people that deal with that, you know, the level of, I feel like if you are a big, famous personality, everyone's going to take their shot when you're in the room with them. And that's their one chance to ask you for something or two. And I think that must be a tough part of it, that a lot of people maybe, you know, until that happens to you, you don't know how taxing it is to always be, you know, put on the spot like that. And it makes me wonder what you've developed in terms of, you know, how you manage your time, like how you say yes to a project, how you decide what to do. And you know, because there's the actor that when a job finally comes along, it's like, of course I'm going to do this. I have nothing else going on. And then there's the level where you have The Daily Show and The Office and you have to make a decision. That's a little harder. But then it's, okay, my career's up here, and how do I keep it there? Or how do I manage that? Or how do I know what to say yes to? So, I mean, is that just the universal conundrum of actually achieving some level of success?
Well, I'll tell you this. You know, I was saying before that in my 20s, I thought, all I got to do is get on, or all the way through my teens, I just wanted to be on Saturday Night Live. And I was like, that's it. Once I'm there, I'm set. You know, that's...
Life ends there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just set. And then my mom was the one to be like, well, what, then what? And I was like, well, then I do movies. Like, I'll be, you know, let's look at Billy Crystal. He was on Saturday Night Live. He's doing all these great, you love his movies, Mom. Like, come on. It's obvious. This is an obvious path. And what... took me a long time to realize, and I think The Daily Show really was that lesson, because when I first started there, I was like, done, set, got it all figured out.
Right.
Is that career, certainly your career, but life in general is just a series of false horizons. And you never really feel like you've got it all under control. And you never really feel like, especially when you're in a kind of uncertain entrepreneurial career, which is really what acting and comedy is. It's you have to self-start a lot. You have to chase things. You have to pursue, and you really just don't know. You don't know what's next. And then you do a movie like The Hangover, and you're like, now I'm set. Like, now everything's fine. But it's not. Like, you gotta hustle. And the one thing that you have to just know is, what, or at least just constantly be asking yourself, is what do you really want? Because if you just want to keep working, well, that's going to like be a, then you're going to make decisions a certain way. If you want to work, if you just want to have fun, that's going to be, you don't want to challenge yourself. You just want to, that's going to be a certain way to make decisions. If you just want to make a shit ton of money, that's a different set of decisions. It's probably some version, there's probably some aspect of all of those things that needs to factor in, and that may, one may have more priority at one different stage in your life, but it usually, I don't know, it just comes down to kind of a gut check, these big career choices each time.
I would think there's a balance thing too, because obviously you can't be in control of how well a film's going to do or how long a television show is going to stay on the air. It's out of your control.
Yeah.
You know, you can do your best in those things, but it's kind of up to the movie gods or whatever, whether it goes crazy. So, I think that in some ways, it's nice that this isn't happening to you when you're 21, because you have to figure out some sort of a balance where you, if you expect every film to be The Hangover, you're always going to be disappointed. Mm-hmm. Or, you know what I mean?
Yeah. When it comes to making career decisions and life decisions, it's a, I think self-awareness is, and just like some level of knowing what's important to you is really what you need to try to root out.
Right.
And it'll inform those things.
Well, it's, you know, I think that one of the really negative things about the quote unquote golden handcuffs of celebrity is that you do get put into a box by your, by public perception being what it is. Oh, he is a comedian. He is that certain kind of comedian. He does those kinds of things. And I would think one of the challenges and ways to remain excited about what you do is to try to break those perceptions. Does that ever cross your mind too? Or is it, I love, you know, this version of myself comically, and I want to keep finding ways to explore that?
I think it's a good, it's a little bit of both, probably more towards the latter. I think a lot of actors are scared of getting pigeonholed or typed or something. I think it's valuable. I think that if we're honest with ourselves about who we are and the kinds of characters we play, they're going to be reasonably close to who we are as people and to some extent. And there are very few actors out there like Christian Bale or a Jim Carrey, or even a Sacha Cohen, these guys that like really get inside and fully transform and live, or a Daniel Day-Lewis, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's who I am, you know? So I love silly comedy, and I'm not going to fight the perception of who I am. I'm going to try to challenge, you know, within a certain spectrum. I'd like to challenge myself and challenge people's expectations and maybe do something more dramatic or even more broad than people associate me with. I think it's kind of a fool's errand to constantly try to, like, just burst the perception of you.
So just coming back around to the Knox speech once again, does the principle of listening to your fear and using it, does that still apply to you today?
Yeah, I mean, that is, if anything, like, it's, the reason that that subject came up in that speech for me is because I think I was struggling with it. And it's something I've always carried with me and believed, but I don't always actually apply in my life. And
just explain the gist of it for people who haven't seen the speech.
The general theme of the speech is that when you're afraid of something, and I don't mean afraid of like a bear or a fire. I mean afraid of like some choice or some emotional circumstance or a relationship or whatever it is, that fear, you can either just run away from that fear, which is kind of what our bodies and our minds tell us to do, or you can look at that fear as a trigger for curiosity and like, I actually need to learn more about this. I need to get inside this more, because most of the time, fear is born out of some form of ignorance or some form of not knowing the whole picture. And it's a good thing to, I would never say just go face your fears. Like, that's a little hacky, and it's also not practical. Like, it's really hard to face your fears, and sometimes it's terrible judgment to face your fears. Like, a lot of fears are justified.
Sure.
But if you look at fear as like information that instead of it being like this behavioral command, run away, look at it as like, this, I need to focus on this. And actually, is my fear justified? Is it not? Is it something I, and then sometimes you realize, I actually don't know and I need to experience it to find out. And that's an instance where you do face the fear and you jump in and you do it. I believe that. I believe that very strongly, that fear is a very helpful emotion or a very helpful feeling, and that it can be, it can just open up so much knowledge about yourself and the world around you. But I'm just as susceptible as anybody to running away from my fears and making easy choices to just dodge them. There's tremendous value in chasing your fears. Don't just face them blindly. Like that to me is not practical advice. But chase them down and try to look them in the eye and
that still applies, that you still find situations like that this far into your career.
Totally. I mean, maybe it's just my personality, but I just don't feel, I always assume I'm going to have it figured out if I can just get over this horizon. You know, it's the whole false horizon thing. But more often than not, and I will have glimpses of like, all right, I'm here. But then, I don't know, a day later, there's right. some reminder like, Ed, you're a schmuck. Let's not forget this. But in a weird way, accepting that you kind of won't ever figure it out and that you will always have these fears and anxieties that plague you and that you will always question a lot of things, that kind of in a way is figuring it out. Like, if you can kind of roll right. with that, and it's just real hard. It's really hard. There's something, again, this sort of the life change that celebrities brought on, just for example, is such a great lesson in like, in facing situations that that might be scarier now that I'm a recognizable person. Social situations or whatever that might be uncomfortable, I just gotta face it, deal with it, roll right. with it.
Well, something that I've thought since, because I met you a long time ago and we've worked together a lot, and you've always struck me as a very genuine guy. And I think in some ways, that's maybe a little harder place to start from and then become, you know, in that bubble, because you are very genuine. You do want to. You genuinely want to make a good impression and listen to somebody, and you're not that person that's just sitting back letting everyone come to them. You lean forward. You lean forward into life, and I've just found that quality about you that, you know, it's a bit vulnerable, but it's also very, you know, it's very human.
Well, that's a huge compliment. I also feel like I'm very analytical. And I can get like, I can deconstruct things too much at times, but it's always been about trying to find some kernel of truth and meaning in what's going on around me.
In any situation.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming and doing this.
My pleasure.
It's been
a blast.
Yeah, and I, there's so much I didn't have any idea about. That, you know, you think you know somebody and then you actually research and start, you know, you start digging into someone's life and you're like, wow, I had no idea.
Well, it's actually, I really like to get into this with someone like you because, I don't know, it forces me to deconstruct a little bit, like think about things that I don't necessarily dig into very often. So, Thank you for that.
Well, it just makes me realize how unproductive I am in by comparison.
Yeah, get to work, Sam.
That's right.
Okay.
I gotta go get to work.
You have just finished listening to another episode of Off Camera. To access more episodes, subscribe, and be a part of the entire Off Camera experience, please visit offcamera.com. This has been a presentation of the NTD Broadcast Network.